Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
Let's talk to Peter Stringer, Ireland's most capped scrum half with 98 Irish international caps, a proud Corkman with over 200 caps for Munster. He's now a certified personal trainer. His online fitness platform, Body Plan by Peter Stringer, which offers fitness training through tailored workouts, is launching this month. PeterStringer.ie is the best place to get more information about that. Peter, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
I'm good, Joe. Yourself? Very well, thank you.
Yeah, good. So this is a new business. It's very exciting. Were you busy coding away? Did you have to learn HTML and Flash and all that kind of stuff from the 90s?
I tell you what, I have an interest. I'm a bit of a tech geek when it comes to it. So I like to understand the workings behind everything. So look, this has been in the pipeline for, I suppose, a couple of years. Is something that I suppose coming out of rugby and the transition period that I had was all about, you know, keeping fit and, you know, training my nutrition. This was the natural progression for me to be able to apply it to a business, be able to apply it to other people's lives, and to add a little bit of support to, I suppose, busy executives and also kind of sports people as well. So it's a nice little model, and I'm very excited about it, you know.
It's a good time to be getting into this. I think particularly post-pandemic, people are very conscious of the fact that they need a work-life balance and they actually do need to look after themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think I've noticed this particularly since I retired, meeting a lot of people in terms of, you know, busy lives, you know, business people who are on the move, people are going to get back out in the cars, they're going to be stuck in offices, maybe at home, and they need to find a little bit of a plan. And for me, coming out of rugby, it's all about that scheduling, sitting down on a Sunday night, getting your schedule in order, because you meet people and it's a case where people say, oh, I might go to the gym after work. It rarely happens, you know, Ger. So it's a case where if you put it in like any other meeting into your week, then you become accountable for that and it becomes a little bit more difficult to go away from that. So again, look, people are looking to get back into gyms, looking to get back into that fitness thing because people have been stuck at home for the majority of their time. And just to be able to help people with scheduling and getting things in place is kind of why I'm here.
Was that a challenge for you at all, Peter, after retirement, given that you are now in control of your own fitness regime? There wasn't coaches in the province or in the national setup looking after you and giving you this regime all the time?
No, actually, I found it actually okay because the last 5 or 6 years I was, I suppose, obviously being in the UK, I suppose being written off and not offer of a contract here in Ireland when I was probably 34, 35 years of age. And I probably took it on board, you know, for myself to make sure that I was in the best possible shape, that I ate well, I trained well. And I did probably more training. I looked after myself better in those last number of years than I would have when even when I was in Ireland. And I would have always been careful of my approach to my training and my food. But I think in the last number of years, that gave me that kind of that extra impetus to be able to do it when I finished. I think a lot of guys probably struggle when they come out of the game. You've got, like you said, S&C coaches, nutritionists, all these people who are laying everything on the line for you day to day. You're told where to be, you're told what to wear, you're told what to eat. And I think guys somewhat struggle when they come out. But for me, I probably had that in place in the previous 5 or 6 years. I always had a love of kind of, I suppose, that nutrition side of it and understanding what food did for my body. So again, I found that a little bit easier. Obviously, two young kids can throw things up in the air and it's not easy at times and lack of sleep. But you write it down at the start of the week and you try and factor it in. It becomes a little bit easier. So it's just helping people kind of around that, and scheduling is what I kind of love doing, you know.
I think a lot of people find that interesting. So every Sunday evening, you sit down with a pen and paper and plan out your week. And I presume it's fairly uniform or how does it work for you?
Yeah, it is. And I suppose the last number of months probably have been very, very busy. Look, with this business and also opening a gym in Cork as well, and, you know, doing a lot of kind of the punditry as well. So things have been busy. And again, family at home and trying to kind of spread that time around. But, you know, you try and get your meetings in place the week before. So you've got your diary, you've got it written out in your phone, whatever it may be. And again, you sit down on a Sunday and you can factor in where you can kind of get your training sessions in. And again, if it's written down, it's like any other meeting, that an appointment comes up on your phone, it flashes up that you've got that time allocated to it, and it becomes a little bit easier to get off the couch, get away from your desk and go and do it. Because, you know, like we're all busy, everyone's busy. So it's, you know, like I said, when it's something at the back of your mind, it rarely gets happened. But if it's there right in front of you, it's becomes a lot more difficult to turn off that notification on the phone and not do it. So it's, it's something I'm obviously passionate about. It's something I have worked very hard over the number of years in terms of my fitness, and it's got me to where I am today in terms of playing till 40. I just want to continue that till, you know, right throughout my kind of my life as it is, you know.
Were you a fitness fanatic as a teenager? Where did it come from?
Yeah, I always was. I suppose I found myself 7 or 8 years of age just randomly going for runs in the evening, kind of after school, and going to the pool and wanting to get fitter. And just, I don't know what it was. I suppose I had this inherent thing growing up that, you know, again, that the kind of size issue when you're playing and people just kind of write you off. And I always wanted to try and find something that would put me ahead of other people. And that was an area where, like, my fitness and obviously working on my skill set in rugby, you know, I was never going to be the biggest. I was never going to be the strongest. So in terms of, you know, you back your fitness and you back your skill sets, it was always about finding an edge for me to be able to compete with other people, that when coaches or whatever, you know, would look at me, they'd say, okay, look, this guy's the fittest, or this guy has got the best pass, we're going to pick him. So I had to find what worked for me and what I was good at. So I made sure that, you know, I was the best at it. So yeah, I worked hard at it. I worked hard, and it was always kind of in the back of my mind to kind of probably, I suppose, when you've got that chip on your shoulder, you want to prove people wrong. So it's, yeah, it's kind of stuck with me from day one, you know.
And on the nutrition side, was it the same thing? Was there a full-time nutritionist at Munster when you began?
Not when we began. It was very kind of in its infancy in terms of, you know, what we were eating. It was all about your standard chicken and pasta. And then when kind of protein became a big component of in and around kind of weight training and recovery, and, you know, nutritionists would come on board then. So, yeah, look, I studied chemistry in university, and I always had a love from that side of things as well. But also when nutritionists would tell me, you know, this is, you know, take this, I always kind of questioned as to why, what it was doing for me and my body. Other people were just kind of, just give it to me and I'll take it, and not kind of really worried about kind of, you know, the effects, you know, protein might have or fats or carbs. But I always had a huge interest from that kind of biological point of view.
So were people like looking over at you in the players' canteen being like, what the hell is Stringer eating there? Or like, how did your nutrition actually differ?
Not that it differed, but it was right. Just kind of an understanding of kind of, I suppose, portion control. Obviously, you know, you've got John Hayes sitting next to me, and he orders in a restaurant, and the same kind of size food arrives out, same size plate, and you kind of work out the kind of the numbers then as you get older, and you kind of figure out, okay, look, obviously John Hayes is nearly twice my weight, but we're eating the same size food. So again, working out those numbers, what kind of you need from a kind of a dietary point of view on a daily basis, depending on your energy expenditure, all those kind of things. So I had a huge passion for kind of learning the fundamentals of it. So yeah, look, it was just about understanding the numbers attached to food and the values attached to food, which I think a lot of people struggle with today, where, you know, you might have a salad, but again, you put a few tablespoons of olive oil in a salad and all of a sudden you're up in 500 or 600 calories. It's trying to educate people on the values and nutritional values attached to food, which is a kind of a passion of mine, really, you know.
And was that something, because we had Paul O'Connell in the studio recently, and he was talking about that wasn't something that they fully understood, or you guys fully understood as a team, that information would come from various people within the group who kind of educated everybody as you went along, until the scientists arrived and started to go, well, actually, you're different from everybody else. You need to behave differently from everybody else.
Yeah, right across the board in terms of food, in terms of your training. I think when I first started, obviously you're doing the same fitness work, whether it's a prop or scrum half or whatever. So you're doing the same fitness work, and that didn't really relate to what you did on the field. So again, after the scientists came in, they analyzed kind of your meters per second and all of those things from a training aspect. And they were able to put preseason programs in place based on your position. So all of those kind of things. And again, it came to food. It was a huge kind of diverse range of players in terms of size, weight, needs, body composition, right throughout the team. So when you look at it like that, it's vastly different for everybody. So once the scientists came on board, I was hugely excited, and I suppose excited to learn about the aspects of what food does for your body and on a daily basis. You know,
were you tempted at any point to get into rugby, to work on this side of it, to be one of those professionals for future generations, or had you had enough of the game when you finished?
I wouldn't say that enough of the game. I still love the game. I still love being at the game. I love analysing the game. I love watching it, and I'm hugely passionate about it. And again, it was trying to find that area look, it might be something I go into down the line and more specific. At the moment, I've found myself, people coming to me when I finish playing and, you know, kind of relations of mine, friends of mine, and kind of working with people who had a very, I suppose, poor understanding of food and I suppose how we're educated in school. And definitely I feel there's an avenue there for people. You know, when you're in school, it's one of those things that people should learn how to be able to cook for themselves and to be able to, like I said, understand kind of food values. Because you leave home, a lot of people leave home and all of a sudden their diet, you know, goes out the window because they don't know what to do. And it's one of those life lessons that people really need. And in terms of professional sport, look, I'd love it. It's again, to be involved in that sphere would be brilliant. But at the moment I'm happy seeing change in people who aren't professional athletes. Doesn't matter if they're professional or not. It's a case where if you can educate someone and you see change in someone and they take it on board, then that becomes rewarding. And from my point of view, that you kind of passed on that little bit of information.
One of the other things that Paul O'Connell said when he was in was he wasn't sure, given his weight profile when he was 16, 17, 18, if he'd have been guaranteed to get an academy contract now. I suspect that his competitive nature would have shone out anyway. But the point he was making was that his body size is now quite small for what the second rows in world rugby are kind of generally accepted to be. Likewise, I suspect that you might have had a similar, it would have been your competitive spirit that was getting you through as opposed to your size and scale. Is there still room for a young Peter Stringer to play for Munster and to play for Ireland? Is Craig Casey proof that there is?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you bring a skill set that people can't, I suppose, avoid looking at and coaches can't, you know, dismiss in terms of selection. Like I said already, when I was younger, I made sure that, you know, what I was good at, I made sure I was the best at it because of the hours that I practiced. And again, it comes down to that basic skill set and, you know, of being able to read a game, being clever about it, understanding the laws of the game, understanding the players around you, how they operate, being able to control guys around you, to direct forwards around you, which was a big learning curve for me coming from UCC and all of a sudden into the Munster setup where you have the likes of Claw, Golov, Axel, Quinny, these guys, and all of a sudden you've got to be the boss of these guys. So, you know, it's finding your voice as you become that player. And again, you know, from a physical point of view, you do what you can in terms of your fitness and your strength. So again, it's finding what you're good at, making sure you work really, really hard on it, because, you know, ultimately that's what's going to get you noticed.
That's a push factor. You're in your internal desire to be the best. What was the pull? Because it sounds like you definitely liked having a bit of a chip on your shoulder. Even, you know, there was a fairly offhand mention 5 minutes ago about being cast aside from Ireland when you were 34 and still playing till you're 40. So that chip was something that you carried with you, and it sounds like you nursed on purpose across your career.
Yeah, look, everyone, you know, no matter who it is, you know, if you hear a comment on the street about somebody or, you know, about yourself, you know, it weighs on you. And I think in today's society and social media and stuff, you know, obviously when I first started, we didn't have that. But again, you have comments from different journalists, from people, and, you know, you take it on board. I was never one that I was outspoken at the time of when I was playing, and I never kind of made an issue of it. I dealt with it internally. I use it, you know, for my benefit, because it's what drove me on. Because, you know, when you're young and when you're a kid and you first start out playing, look, I got a lot of grief. My parents got a lot of grief for putting me out in the field from other parents. So again, all of those things, I have no doubt, I suppose, had this kind of factor, this kind of created this resilience within me. And again, it's about that, proving people wrong and taking that with you without making a big issue of it, without making a kind of a public knowledge. But you use it to your advantage. You use it to kind of drive you on. And again, when someone puts you down and someone tells you you can't do something, what's the first thing you want to go and do is go and do it and prove them wrong. So it's something that, look, I've carried with me. I've used it as a positive. You know, I know guys certainly kind of struggle with comments when certain people kind of pass it their way. But, you know, I was fortunate enough that I went the other way and I was able to use it in a positive way, you know.
That's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tricky. It is tricky because I think inherently you're, maybe there's an element of, you know, being born with a certain type of resilience and being able to add to it. You know, some guys certainly I've seen in the past and I've spoken to, you know, take things to heart, and you can see guys go the other way and go into themselves. And it's about being, you know, analyzing. When I work with a couple of young scrum halves and, you know, just in a club scene and trying to bring that kind of confidence out of them, you see something in them and you try and work really hard and make sure that they know that they're good at something. So it's trying to get that kind of that balance with, you know, pushing someone, you know, to that edge to work really hard. And using the negative thoughts that they have and turn it into a positive way, because it's some people do struggle with it and it takes a little bit of time, but I think the rewards on the back of it, you know, you can see someone and they can actually use that. So anytime anybody throws those negative comments, you know, they've got this in the back of their mind, knowing that they can do something, they can push on.
Yeah, it definitely is something that some people are good at dealing with and learn how to deal with. And then, as you said, it can be the ruination of other individuals. Can we talk a little bit about the Ireland situation at the moment? Because we've all been fascinated with what's going to happen at the number 10 position. Johnny Sexton is the Ireland captain, and as it stands at the moment, is the incumbent. It'll be interesting to see if this hip injury is bad enough to keep him out of the Japan game and what happens. But likewise, we're kind of not really focused that much on the 9 situation, when actually it is as competitive and uncertain now as it has been at any point. Obviously, Conor Murray played really well for the Lions and looks like he is back to being our number one, but hasn't played since. So what's the scenario? What is the depth chart as it stands at the moment?
Well, the depth chart is pretty good. You look at the internal battles within Munster to an extent, with Craig Casey getting regular game time. You look at the battle for the number 9 jersey at Leinster. It's not a shoe-in, you know, in either of them. Again, you look at Ulster now with Nathan Doak coming on the scene, with John Cooney out. Guys have opportunities to play. And if they play well, they're going to hold on to that jersey. Again, Connacht are fighting as well with Blade and Marmy. So in every province, you now have two really, really good scrum halves. So there's a pool there of players that could push on. Obviously, younger guys with Doak coming through, you know, you'd probably think it's something on the horizon for them. But obviously, it's a little bit early, I think. But again, you look at that pool now and you talk about Murray. Like, you know, he'll obviously, I think, be involved this weekend for Munster, get him some game time. And then he's looking at Japan. So from my point of view, I think the fact that Ireland are probably, you know, undercooked going into this series compared to the Southern Hemisphere sides, you know, does Andy Farrell, you know, revert to a kind of a structured game plan, a game plan that they know, that they've worked over the last number of years? You'd love to have seen Ireland, you know, play, you know, in the summer in the States, and to just try and develop some of those younger guys and get them a bit of an opportunity to play in a green jersey. So, you know, again, you look at the likes of Luke McGrath, again, in Jameson Gibson Park and Leinster. I think that's a real battle. And I think that, you know, it's a flick of a coin in terms of that Leinster jersey. But Andy Farrell, I think, you know, when you look at Jameson Gibson Park, and I've been really impressed with him anytime he's played in the Irish jersey. I think he adds something different. I think, you know, in terms of his all-round game, his kicking game, his attacking game, the way he can bring forwards into it. I think he's a good passing game. I think he adds another element, another dimension to Ireland's play. But again, it comes back to what type of game Ireland want to play. Do they want to have that structured kicking game? And obviously Connor's suited to that. I think he's that physical guy that we all know. And I think he has shown signs of coming back to where he was. I don't think he's anywhere close to it in terms of, you know, his ability to take guys on and have that kind of, I suppose, impotence that he has kind of around the fringes. But I think, you know, but on the back of the Lions, I think he'll be the starting 9. But again, it's just about getting that game time in the meantime, and just trying to understand what Andy Farrell is trying to do with the team and how he wants them to play, you know.
As a test scrum half, how much exposure do you need and how many minutes do you need before you can feel comfortable at that level? And I guess what I'm asking here is, how soon do we need to be getting Craig Casey or Nathan Doak, as it may turn out, into one of these test matches and getting them meaningful game time?
Yeah, like, I think it's all well and good, you know, Craig Casey playing in the URC at the moment. And I suppose against teams where, if we're honest, you know, the Champions Cup is another step up. International is another step up. And I think to get guys ready for that international scene, we need to get them playing, absolutely. I think Champions Cup is the next step for a lot of these guys. You know, Craig Casey hasn't had much exposure at that level. Yes, he's had a few appearances off the bench. But again, a lot will tell in, you know, after these, I suppose, internationals and getting guys opportunities to play, which is, you know, we don't have those Champions Cup games to kind of put out those feelers for guys before these internationals, which is unfortunate, which may stand against a lot of these kind of younger guys, because that level that you go from a week in, week out URC into an international against Japan or the All Blacks or Argentina, whatever it may be, is massive. And I think, you know, it'd be unfair on guys, I think, to not have had regular Champions Cup action before we see them at international stage. Yes, there are outliers in every scenario, but I think for the most part, I think it wouldn't be suited for, I suppose, the guys to be in a position to play at an international level on the back of, I suppose, the quality games that we've seen so far.
So assuming fitness, you think it's going to be Murray and Sexton starting at 9 and 10 for the All Blacks game?
Yeah, I do. I see it like that. I think that's what Andy Farrell will go with. But I certainly see, as a nine, Jameson Gibson-Park playing a huge role across the three games. Again, you look at the Japan game, I think Ireland probably will want to go into it with a bit of a kind of a structured kicking game, because I think on the back of, you know, Japan, probably, you know, the type of game that they play, the last thing kind of Ireland want to do is go into their first international, throw the ball around, not be that familiar with each other. It's going to take a little bit of time, and having it a bit of a loose game, I don't think that's not going to be the plan. I think so. It'll be a case of trying to strangle the Japanese, because you look at what the way the provinces have been playing, particularly Munster and Leinster, and Ulster again to an extent, driving malls. You get into that 22, it's all that close quarter pick and go, and that kind of power game. So I'd expect to see a lot of that from Ireland in the opening game, certainly, just so that they get a game under their belt. And then, you know, who knows as the games go on, if we see a little bit of evolution, a little bit of, I suppose, expansive play. And I'd be wary of throwing guys in there, bit of a kind of an offload game, because against the Japanese you're gonna struggle if you give them any sort of loose ball, you know.
Yeah, one last thing on that is that there wasn't a whole heap of opportunity for all of the best players to be together many different occasions to implement a new game plan. So maybe everybody needs to rein their expectations in for this series of games.
Yeah, I'd agree. I, you know, as much as we all want to see, you know, free flowing offload rugby, expansive rugby, you know, and I think players within the provinces, I think we've seen glimpses of certain guys, I think, developing and evolving as players. But again, you'd like to see them carry that to the international stage. But again, I don't think we'll see it in these early games because of the opposition that we're playing against. And it's a time where, again, like you said, guys haven't been playing together. Guys are coming back from Lions duty, to come back from that into an Irish setup directly without having played alongside each other provincially for too many games. It's challenging. There's no way around it. And the only way you can get around it is getting these guys on the field and just figuring it out as they go through it, you know.
So just to be clear, the order is Murray is number one at the moment. Gibson Park is a close second. Who's third for you at the moment?
I think looking at the squad, I think Casey's going to be in there. I think what he's done in the last number of months, I think he, you know, to have him as that third guy in the squad and to be seen as, you know, the future, I think that's the way it's going to go. Because to have him around the squad, I think, again, even though he might get much game time in the autumn games, to have him around, I think, you know, that's part of that learning process. Where guys, you talk about that step up from the URC, and the next best thing you can do when there's no games, you know, no provincial games on at that time, is to have him in that environment. So, I think Luke McGrath will be very unlucky. I think Caelan Blade will be very unlucky. I think to miss out if that's the way it goes, because they perform week in, week out, and it's just, again, it's a case of picking three out of like I said, you've got eight scrum halves who are potentially could be wearing a green jersey, you know, if not now, if in a couple of years. So, you know, who knows? And it's just so competitive. You look at the back row, you look at, you know, you know, you've spoken about it before, that the, right across the board, there is serious strength and depth if we can get a game plan in place that suits the players in those positions. I think it's exciting times.
Okay, one last thing I did want to ask you about was Ultimate Hell Week. I didn't see the whole thing, but anytime I saw it, there was angry people shouting at you, faces covered in spit and snot, exhaustion, yeah, heavy breathing. Was it enjoyable? Are you a masochist?
It sounds like you're describing a training session down in Musgrave Park at some point. But it was, look, it was grim. I'm not going to lie about it. And what you saw, like, I think they had to tone it down for television a lot. It was, they didn't really get across the aspect of our serious lack of sleep. It was 3 days before we got a half an hour sleep. We were probably eating about 400 calories a day. I was burning about 5,000 calories a day. So I lost 6 kg in 5 days, which I didn't really have to lose at that time. But again, it was just mentally more than the physical challenges. I suppose I prepared myself. Again, it's someone I'd probably live with regrets if I didn't prepare properly. But that physical aspect of training, you know, you knew there was going to be an element of a rucksack on your back, and that heavy weight going up a mountain for 5-6 hours, whatever it was. So it's the mental side of it. It's that day-to-day stuff where they're, again, like you said, shouting in your face, making sure that your water bottles are full. If they're not full, you get it over your head. So you end up being dehydrated for the 5 days because you're afraid to take a sip out of the water because they come in and check your water bottle and they put it over you. So it's all those little things where they're, you know, you can never do something. You never get praised for it. It's always wrong. And that's just part of the process where they try and break you mentally. But yeah, look, it was just something that my wife said to me. She said, look, I'm not seeing you till Sunday night. So that kind of gave me the motivation to kind of stay there and to kind of carry on. And you know, two young kids at home. She said, oh, I'd take Hell Week over it. I said, I'll tell you what, it was absolutely, it was hell. But something unbelievable to do something as an individual, I suppose, coming out of a team environment, team sport, probably, you know, the first thing that I would have probably achieved. Yes, there was a team element to it, but in terms of that experience and your own mental approach and your thoughts, you know, trying to battle those kind of moments in your head was, it was a very emotional experience and something that I'm delighted I did, but never, ever do something like it again.
Okay, fair enough. And I suspect that there will be none of that in Body Plan by Peter Stringer.
not unless people want it, but it'd certainly be a much calmer approach, to be a lot more, I suppose, of a sympathetic ear, a lot more listening, and again, it'll be helping people. It won't be putting them through that much pain. There'll be a little bit of pain, but nothing like Hell Week. No.
Well, listen, when does it actually go live? Check out peterstringer.ie now. But when?
Yeah, it's live. It's live now. It's great. Live now. So people log on to peterstringer.ie and follow the process. There's exercise library there, well over 400 exercises, and fill out forms and I'll be back to them for training programs.
We wish you the very best of luck with it. Continued success, Peter. Thanks for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers, guys. Thank you very much. Cheers.